Hello and welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you're listening to episode number 26. On this week's show, we've got some photo news, some contest news, some interviews, and of course, we'll round things out with our listener questions and answers. Lots of good stuff coming up this week, so don't go away. Welcome back. In our first segment here on Learning Digital Photography, there are quite a bit of news points that I wanted to bring up. First off, this Saturday is the actual date of the Worldwide Photo Walk, started by none other than Scott Kelby. That's coming up this weekend, July 18th, so if you have not signed up yet, there may still be time to register at the website. You want to go over to worldwidephotowalk.com and see if there's any openings in a city near you. It's going to be a very exciting event, and I'll be participating in one here in Denver. I'll share my thoughts and feedback on that after the walk this weekend, but it's a great opportunity to get out and meet fellow photographers and really get some experience, not only networking with others, but also getting some good camera time in too. I've gotten a lot of good shots out of photo walks. They are a lot of fun. So make sure you go over to worldwidephotowalk.com and register in a city near you, if you haven't already, of course. The next item in the news this week is an interesting find I saw on Forbes.com, which is a financial website. And there have been some changes in the way they look at people who take deductions. One of the things that they've been cracking down on is that of hobby losses. So for those of us who are hobbyists and enthusiasts, if you're taking deductions on your hobby, the IRS might be looking at you a little more carefully. Because if you're not turning a profit in any two of 5 years, then you are not qualified to take that deduction when you have a quote-unquote loss. There's a lot of new rules and things they're looking out for, so I'll go ahead and throw a link to that in the show notes. But you want to make sure that you're not taking deductions if you're not actually out there earning income and earning revenue from your photography work. If you're just doing it as a hobby or as an enthusiast, technically you're not supposed to be taking those deductions. That should just be a hobby expense. It's not a hobby loss on your taxes. So for those of you in the U.S., you may want to check out that website. It offers some good resources and suggestions for how you can actually make sure that you're compliant with the IRS tax code. So that is the second little news item there. Another little fun or interesting news item I saw on the CPN website, which is the Canon Professional Network, over at CanonEurope.com. They've got this online depth of field calculator for Canon cameras. It's a pretty cool thing. You insert your camera type, whether you shoot with an XT, a 20D, a 30D, a 40D, a 1D Mark II, whatever body you shoot with, and then you insert your lens into the second field there, and then you specify all the details for the shooting distance that you want to shoot at. It will tell you what your depth of field will be, what your minimum close distance is, what your hyperfocal distance is, things of that nature. It's a pretty cool utility. I've seen other ones out there. This is one that's coming from Canon, though, and being the Canon blogger, I guess, kind of merits me pointing that out in the podcast this week. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes, but it's kind of a neat little utility there, so feel free to check that out at your leisure. Another little news flash for you here. I saw that Ritz camera stores are actually heading to auction. Their last 400 stores decided they couldn't make it out of bankruptcy and maintain those stores with the stock, bringing in new product lines for the fall. They really couldn't afford to do that, so they're selling off their 400 remaining stores. This isn't new news, really, that they were in bankruptcy proceedings because they had been having some tough financial times, but they have decided to sell off the last of their 400 stores at auction. So for those of you that may be interested in purchasing some gear, you may want to look at Ritz Camera. They could be offering some discounts in the very near future. They're trying to do this by the end of the month, so it might be happening rather quickly. Stop in Ritz Camera today to see if you can snag some deals. Next up in the news, there is a cool little flash site over on Canon's Japan website, so it's web.canon.jp, and it's got a neat little story there on the development of the EOS 1 series. That's the EOS 1D Mark II, 1D Mark III, the whole 1 series. It's got a great little flash there with a bunch of little tidbits and interesting notes about that all talk about the story of its development. Pretty well laid out, nice, useful information there. If you've got a couple minutes, go ahead and stop by there and check that out. I think it has been up for a while. Just found that when I was surfing around for the news nuggets for this week's show. So I would encourage you to stop by there if you've got a few minutes and want to learn a little bit more about the history. It's a pretty neat little tidbit there. The last thing that's also kind of Canon related is it looks like they're extending their rebates on lenses and speedlights. The rebate program for the spring usually ends around this time, I think July 11th, so today is the cutoff date, or yesterday, depending on where you're listening to this, but July 11th was the cutoff date for rebates, and it looks like they have extended that to August 8th on a variety of lenses and speed lights, so you're going to want to go to the promotions page where they feature their rebates to see if there's anything you're in the market for that they may still be discounting through the 8th. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes as well. So that's it for this week in the photo news. I had a lot of bullet points there. I'll go ahead and make sure I throw the links to those news items in the show notes for those of you that want to get more details and more information. But coming up right after the break, I'm going to go into our interview session for this week. This week I'm talking with Terry Reinert of TKR Photo. He and I have a lot in common with regard to our interest in HDR photography, and he's also is a programming engineer, so I was picking his brain on engineering and programming and things of that nature. So you're going to want to make sure you stick around and catch this discussion. It had a lot of fun moments in there. I did want to take a moment to thank Terry for taking the time to sit down and talk with us, but I'll be talking with him coming up right after the break, so don't go away. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. I'm on the phone now with Terry Reinert of TKR Photo. Terry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I had quite a bit I wanted to talk to you about. I noticed your blog, actually, you titled it Art and Engineering, Where They Collide, and I thought that was a rather interesting combination because, from what I understand, you come from an engineering background, correct? You do a lot of like web software designers. What kind of software design do you do again?
Well, my main background is actually in embedded hardware. I used to do a lot of avionics systems for small general aviation aircraft, all software engineering. My educational background is in computer engineering. And, now I'm working for a different company doing just a lot of desktop Java level programming. So that's, I hardly ever do any actual web programming other than for fun. So I kind of picked up PHP and MySQL and all that stuff for fun. And, I'm sure knowing that I do that for fun, you can kind of place me in that kind of nerdy category.
I think we're all nerds in that regard when it comes to the software or the web engineering. But that software engineering interests me because that probably would tie into the – I've seen a lot of things like in Photoshop where you can do scripting and things like that where you can like program Photoshop or Lightroom or whatever programs to do certain things for you.
Oh, yeah. It's they actually have it pretty advanced scripting engine, Adobe does, and it spans across a couple of their programs. I think InDesign, Illustrator, Photoshop, and I'm pretty sure you can do some scripting in Bridge and in Bridge as well. Lightroom requires, I think, plugins. It doesn't quite fit into the scripting engine that runs the other programs, but they support three main languages, AppleScript, VBScript, and what they call ExtendScript, which is basically JavaScript that they have added some stuff to and extended it to make it a little bit better for what they want it to do. And it's a pretty powerful system.
So I didn't realize you could do all that kind of programming, or I guess scripting, as you said. What kind of advantages does that have? What you said, it's Photoshop, InDesign, Illustrator, and what was the other one?
Bridge, I think Bridge can do it, and I think there's one other one. Don't hold me to Bridge, but I'm pretty sure that one does.
Oh, I bet your Flash has it too, doesn't it?
It might. I'm not sure on that one.
I think I remember seeing something about the extend script. When you said extend script, I think I remembered seeing that when I did a trial version of Flash for 30 days, and I used it for all of one until I gave up on it, because that stuff was just really confusing for me. I'm not sure I could ever completely understand that, but I thought it might be helpful if you could maybe go into a little bit of the basics as to why we would want a script in Photoshop, Illustrator, wherever. You know, what good does that do? Does it make things work better? Does it make things work faster? You know, why would we want to script in Adobe applications?
Well, a lot of people use actions now, and actions are really easy because you just pull up the action palette, you know, hit record, and then start clicking buttons and doing your thing, and when you're done, you hit stop, and then you can kind of just rerun that action on any other photo that you want. And right. Scripting is pretty much exactly the same thing. You can take tedious, repetitive tasks that you do over and over and over again and spend a little bit of time, write a script for it, and then the next thing you know, you can keep running it over and over and over again. But where they differ from actions is a couple of different ways. One, you can do a lot more with scripts because you can use conditional logic. So you can use if-then statements. You can run, you know, while loops, for loops, and things of that nature. So you have a lot more control over what you're doing than in actions. And
okay.
So you think, you know, an if-then statement, you know, what's the big deal about that? Well, it actually does have a huge impact when you really get down into writing these scripts to do even the little common things.
I get you.
So it's basically a lot more powerful than actions.
Because with an action, you can't set conditions. You can't say if condition X exists, then do Y, whereas you can do that with scripting.
Exactly. And also with the scripting, you can also open files, save files in different formats. You can't do any of that in actions. So it gives you a lot more power.
So I could take a PSD file in Photoshop and script it to save down as a JPEG, a GIF, and a PNG file if I wanted to?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah. And not only that, but say, you know, a script, one of the ones I've been working on lately is you can take a folder that's full of files. Say you have five files in a folder. You can open all five of them, resize them, merge them all into the same document, you know, position them wherever you want to if you know where you want to do it beforehand. So kind of like making like the standard composition that you use over and over again for picture packages or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Add strokes to the layers. You know, flatten the image, run a unsharp mask on it, and then, you know,
you
save it as a high res and a low res.
You can do all that in scripting. Wow, that's very powerful. So say I had a folder of, say, I don't know, like I go out on a photo shoot, I go on a sunset photo shoot, and I took, there were 100 pictures, and I took 30 pictures of a pano that I did at three different exposures in each set for the panel. Could I then script that to, say, take photo 1, photo 4, photo 7, photo 10, and stitch those together as a pano, and then 2, God, I can't do the math, 2, 5, 8, and stitch those together as a pano?
Yeah, you could do something like that, but you'd want to look at, I know Photoshop and, you know, integrated with Lightroom and Bridge already has that merge to pano. I'm pretty sure it does.
Right.
Or, you know, in Photoshop you can do it. So,
so you're saying use the Photoshop utility for that. Gotcha. Okay.
Right. I mean, that's one of the big things that engineers struggle with is, you know, we love to reinvent the wheel, or we always want to reinvent the wheel because we always think as an individual, hey, I could do that better than the other guy.
Even though the other guy's getting paid to do it and I'm just
– Right. But when it really comes down to it, it's like, why reinvent the wheel when you can just, you know, drag and drop code and – now, you know, you didn't waste time doing it. You can move on and, you know, get your product done faster. So it's one of those, anytime you come up with an idea for a script, look and see if someone's already done it or if, you know, Photoshop already has it built in, like, you know, merge to HDR. Photoshop already has a script for that and it works great. We use it all the time. Okay. But, you know, okay. So you don't really want to write your own for it.
Gotcha. I see. So how would you know if someone else is, like, say, for you made a good example where Photoshop has a merge to HDR and they also have it stitched together for pano. What if you wanted to combine those two things? Could you do that with scripting?
I hesitate to say because I haven't actually looked at it. I like to kind of feel out and see, but I'm pretty sure you could probably come up with something to do it because
That's
one of the
cool.
other nice things is from one script, you can run another script.
So there you go.
You could use their scripts and then just write your own to kind of tie it all together.
And that's really fascinating because I know and you and I had both done a little bit of previous blog posting on HDR, and we can get to that in a minute, but I know we had talked about HDR in the past respectively on our individual blogs, but we hadn't really talked about doing panorama work, and I thought that might be kind of an interesting thing to kind of put together. Like imagine doing a pano at neutral exposure, doing that same pano at one stop under, and then that same pano at one stop over. You know, would it be possible then theoretically to do an HDR pano? So that's one of the things that I'd always thought about doing, and I guess that would, when I noticed that you did a lot of scripting background, I thought that might be a question that you could answer, but I guess there's still some research to be done in that vein. So cool. That's very cool.
You could definitely do something like that manually, you know, merging your panos and then merging the HDRs, but it's one of those, you're counting on the algorithm, the pano merge algorithm to do the same thing for all three sets of photos.
Gotcha.
And, you know, if that one, if you know, just a little bit different is done, then maybe your aligning algorithms and the merge to HDR aren't going to quite line up. So it'd be one of those we'd have to experiment and see. It's right. Definitely theoretically possible, but whether
but if that boat moves out there on the water, if that boat moves on the water, you're screwed. Cause...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So it sounds like scripting really is just more of an advanced action programming thing where you can just get repetitive actions done much more quickly.
Yep.
That be an accurate statement?
Yes, absolutely. You can do a lot more with the scripting than you can with actions. And, you know, it does take a little bit of time to learn it because you are going to be learning I say you're going to be learning scripting because you're not learning programming, because scripting and programming do have major differences, but a lot of people kind of that don't know anything about programming lump them both into the same thing. You know, hey, I'm writing code, it's programming, not scripting, or vice versa. But, you know, the scripting is like programming light, and it's really not that hard to figure out. You know, just take some time.
And that's what I've noticed about the stuff on the website, because I started out doing web work with HTML, where the statements, quote-unquote statements, and for those of you that we might be leaving behind, I promise I will only talk about this briefly, but the statements in HTML are fairly straightforward, or started as fairly straightforward, to where if you wanted something bold, you'd put a B bracket before and a B bracket after. If you wanted something centered, you'd put a center bracket before and a center bracket after. So it sounds like scripting in Adobe applications like Photoshop and InDesign and Illustrator, would that follow similar, I guess, semantics where the words are pretty straightforward once you know the language?
Yeah. Well, what it is to apply that same idea to the scripting, what you have is what's called an API, an application programming interface, or might mean something else.
But, that sounds right. I'll believe that. Why not? Sure. Application.
Hey, it sounds good. So we'll run with it, you know.
We'll run with that. Sure.
You're going to have a bunch of comments on your blog being like, man, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, he knows more than I do, so.
You know, Adobe's got a bunch of documents out on scripting and their API interfaces. And basically, you have a bunch of constants, classes, or objects, if you want to call them that, and the functions contained within them. So, for example, if I wanted to find out what, you know, grab a variable and fill it with the height and the width of my document, my image, you know, I would create my own variable, but I would look to the document object that holds all the information about the document, which would say be, you know, docref, you know, whatever my variable I wanted to name it, and then just period height. And that's the height of my image. It's already there in the document, so you just access it through the API. And then I do the same thing with the width, and now I have two variables that I can play with mathematically and do whatever I want with that can affect the height and width of whatever I want to do with that image.
And you could do that with any number of images once you have that set. So like you said, if you have a folder of 200 images, you just start the script, walk away, grab a cup of coffee, come back half an hour later, and it's done.
Exactly.
Cool.
the nice thing is it's, none of it is set. So like with an action, just, I don't want to take up too much time, but with an action, there's this feature, there's this trick that I really love that I learned from taking a course at Photoshop World that Scott Kelby taught. And I don't remember what he calls it, but I call it the Scott Kelby beauty border. And basically what it is just really quick, down and dirty, is you grab the rectangular marquee tool, select a large portion of the center of an image, and then feather it by like 250. So you heavy feather, and then hit delete, clear out your selection, and then set that new layer. Sorry, you have to duplicate the background layer first, and then set that layer that you just made the selection and deleted the cleared the center contents out of it, set it to multiply. And what that does is it just creates this nice little dark border around the edge that if you lower the opacity just a little bit, you can't really tell that it's there, but it kind of traps the user's eyes on the image. And gotcha. I think it makes the image, you know, a lot of images, it really adds a lot to it, especially if it's done subtly.
Right.
Well, if you use an action to do that, and say on I have one image that's an 8x10 at 300 DPI, well, I make my selection like 1 inch from each edge. Well, when I go to apply that same action to another photo that's, say, a 4x6 at 72 DPI, all of a sudden it doesn't work because the action has the size of that selection set constant. Whereas with a script, the second it runs on a new image, the first thing I have it do is grab the width and the height and then basically shrink it down by about 10%.
Right.
So that way you have just that tiny little border around the edge. And now when you go to images of different sizes, it's going to work perfect for all of them.
Right. Wow, that is cool. That is really cool. Hang on 1 second, Terry. We have to take a short break here, and we'll come back in just a minute, and we're going to pick up where we left off and talk a little bit about HDR. Terry, that was really fascinating stuff about scripting as we just segue between segments there with the music in the background. I was talking to Terry about how the fact that I'd love to see something more cohesive on than just a 15-minute conversation. And hopefully at the end of the show, if he could make a couple of recommendations as to what some good resources are that are available online, that could help as well. But what I'd like to do now, Terry, if you have some time, is talk a little bit about your HDR work, because I noticed from your blog, like I said, we'd both talked about it in the past, but you seem to have a lot more of the workflow down. Like, I know when I was talking about doing apertures and shutters and how to set them and how to move from a bracket of 3 to a bracket of 9, whether you're using shutter or aperture. But I noticed that you also talked more about the photomatic side and how you actually process and do this stuff called tone mapping, which I know a little bit about, but you've definitely got a lot wider knowledge base there. So I was wondering if you could take a couple minutes and tell us how you got into HDR and what your workflow is like, what works for you.
Okay, sure. Well, I kind of heard HDR just, you know, surfing the net and stuff and like that. It's kind of the, you know, when it started becoming popular, it was the big buzzword. And I didn't really think too much about it until I went to Photoshop World in Orlando in 2008. It was April of 08. And I took a class with Ben Wilmore, and he was basically showing what HDR was and how he did it. And he showed Photomatics and a lot of his images. And Ben just does absolutely stunning HDR work, and that kind of got me hooked.
Ben is Ben, so yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that was like the one class, you know, no offense to any of their instructors because they were all great, but, you know, Ben's class was the one that reached me at the level to where I wanted to go out of the conference room with my camera and start shooting right then and there to do what he was talking about. I mean, that one really just caught my interest.
Sure.
And so that's kind of where I picked it up from, and then, you know, from there, just, you know, looking around on the internet, the debate rages on HDR. You know, a lot of people think it's great. A lot of people think it's horrible. And sure. I don't get into those debates because I really don't care. I look at the end result. That's what matters to me. And some of the people who have just these great end results, you know, I was looking at them on Flickr and on their websites, and just some of them, like Trey Ratcliffe, he posted a tutorial on how he does it. This other guy on Flickr that I really liked, I can't think of his name right now, but he's from, I think he's either Polish or somewhere in England, or sorry, not England, in Europe. Jeez.
You know what? I didn't even catch that. I'm just like, yeah, that makes sense. Poland.
I'm just my brain is not quite working quite well.
Hey, see, it's getting late, so we're talking here late at night, folks. So you got to bear with us. We tried to make both our schedules match, and the only time was really later in the evening. So if we start getting really weird later in the conversation, just chalk it up to time. Chalk it up to time. So
that's what. Yeah, we'll blame it on the evening. That's
it's too late. We had too many beers or water. Coke. We're drinking water. That's what it is. I'm sorry, but anyway, go back. You said about the HDR work that you noticed on the web.
Right. So I kind of took all their tutorials, and each one kind of brought something new to the table. And, I mean, even some of the posts that you had made on your blog on how you had actually done the photography side of things, capturing the 9 images, taking into account Canon's limitation of 3 shots in bracket mode and stuff. I just kind of took all those things and took what I liked out of it and merged them kind of into my own little workflow that works for me, and it works great for me. It might not work for other people. They might not like it, but that's what works for me, and that's what I really like.
So once you do your I guess my question more than is, after capture, once you've done like the bracketing and the exposures, whether it's 3 shots, 5 shots, 6 shots, 9 shots, whatever, and you go into post, you said you're using Photomatix as well for your post processing?
Yeah, I use a mixture of programs. I have you know, Photoshop, obviously Photoshop CS3 and Photoshop CS4, and I usually use that to do the merge because I've found, at least for me, in the types of stuff that I shoot in HDR, Photoshop seems to align the images and merge them better than any of the other ones.
Really? Okay. I didn't know that. That's good to know.
Yep. So I like Photoshop for that. And then to actually do the tone mapping, I use a couple of different programs. I have Photomatix, and I really love Photomatix. But a lot of times with Photomatix, you can get this, the quality out of it. You can go from just extremely overdone, cartoony, outlandish, crazy.
Harry Potter type.
Yeah, exactly. And then, or you could go mostly realistic. And I say mostly realistic because you can get extremely realistic out of it, but you're going to be dropping like your strength and your saturation and some of those sliders way down. And, you know, what I have found for the extremely realistic ones is actually a program called HDR Photo Studio, and Unified Color makes that. It's a new one. They just released it less than a year ago. And what's crazy about it is they actually have a couple of patents on this new imaging way of handling color. And instead of slaving their color gamut to, say, an LCD screen or a CRT screen, they basically invented the color gamut for the human eye.
Wow.
So as technology gets better, your images that you processed with it will look better, you know, as the screen technologies get better. So it's really neat, but I've found that program, it's extremely easy to use, really nice to use. I really like it, and I have gotten, like, very, very good realistic images out of that.
Sure, yeah. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around when you just said they invented a color gamut for the human eye. Wow, that's pretty intense. Wow.
Yeah, they talk about it on their website a lot.
Yeah, we'll throw a link to let's get that website up. We'll throw a link to that in the show notes. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll have a link to the Photomatix website. I think that's HDR Soft or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then this other one that you were just talking about, we'll throw a link up for that one as well. And, of course, everyone knows where to get Photoshop from, so we won't worry about Adobe's link. They've got enough of their own PR. Are there any other software tools that you use in your HDR workflow?
Those are pretty much it. You know, what I'll end up doing is my workflow is merge in Photoshop and then save it as a Radiance file, and then either
as a what file would you call that?
Radiance is the type. It's .hdr.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that's what that was referred to as. I just called
Yeah.
it an HDR file. Oh, okay. Okay. Radiant. So that's good to know. See, I'm learning something every day here. This is awesome.
So then I'll either take it into either one, either Photomatix or HDR Photo Studio, and process it from there. And then once I get the result that I want there out of that, I'll save it and then take it either into Lightroom or back into Photoshop and continue to process it from there, because I'm one of those where I want it to be what I want it to be, and if I don't have it there, then I'm not done with it yet. And usually
Right.
getting it out of Photomatix or out of HDR Photo Studio, there's still something about it that I don't like. And so I always go back into Photoshop to either, continue to work on noise reduction, maybe tweak spot edit, tweak it here or there, whatever I need to do.
Little dodging and burning or whatever, right? Yeah, that's
Yeah,
very
exactly.
cool. So have you ever found yourself taking an image through the Photoshop and then into both the Photo Studio and the Photomatix to pull benefits from both of those applications, or do you find yourself usually using one or the other?
Usually it's one or the other, because
Okay.
the tone mapping in Photomatix is the same thing that HDR Photo calls, I think they call it like dynamic mapping or dynamic something or another mapping.
I
But
got you. Gotcha.
they kind of perform the same kind of task.
Gotcha.
So
So no need to perform the same thing twice. Like you said, no need to reinvent the wheel kind of thing.
right, exactly. Because once you do the tone mapping, you've essentially took your HDR image with all that image data that the computer can't actually display, and then you've mapped it down, and there's no reason to do it again. But
Gotcha.
what you could do is you could do all the processing in, say, HDR Photo Studio, and then open the single file in Photomatix, and like, how people fake an HDR with a single image, you could do something like that. But I'm kind of against that practice, so I would never do it myself.
I tried that once or twice. I tried to fake an HDR actually straight in Photoshop before I learned about HDR Soft and now about HDR Photo Studio. And the results were thoroughly unimpressive. So HDR, I don't think, is something you really want to try to fake with only one or two images, just because the quality of the results are going to be so much lower than they could otherwise be if you had more exposures to work with.
Right, that's exactly it. I've seen some. Now, I have seen some that were single image and then processed in Photomatix that actually came out pretty nice. I mean, they weren't
Really?
bad, but very few, very, far between.
Probably more the
So.
exception than the rule, I would say, right?
Exactly,
Yeah,
exactly.
cool. And I know you did a couple of HDR tutorials up on your blog as well, correct? You had a couple that really seemed to gain a lot of interest and popularity, where you talked about your workflow and your methodology and what you used. If we could get links for those, if you could email those to me, or I can just pull them up off your blog. We'll include those blog posts in the show notes as well. So for those of you that haven't stopped by Terry's blog, we'll have links to those specific posts, and we'll talk more about his blog in just a minute here. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Terry about some of his photography work, who he's worked with. He's actually worked with a couple of pretty famous people, and then talk to him about the social networking, the blog stuff, the website stuff he does, and how you can get a hold of him. So stay tuned, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Like I said, we're talking here with Terry Reinert of TKR Photo, and I wanted to also take a minute and talk to you, Terry, about the photography work you've done. I noticed on Scott Kelby's blog, one of his guest bloggers recently was Robert Vanelli, and he actually linked back to your website. And I was like, hey, I know him. And it was very exciting to see your name over on Scott Kelby's blog, and I also didn't know that you shot with Robert before, and he's a very well-known photographer. So I was wondering if you'd be interested in taking a couple minutes to talk about your work with him, what you learned from him, what kind of stuff you incorporate into working as a photo assistant for a pretty well-known professional like that. And if you wanted to just take a couple minutes and talk about that kind of stuff, I know at least I'm interested in that. I'm sure other listeners are as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Vanelli is a good friend of mine. He's actually my karate instructor also. I've been taking karate with him for many, many, many years now. And he's just, I mean, ever since I met him, he's just been a really good guy, really good friend. And he loves to teach. And, you know, one of the things that he does is he teaches at a local elementary school, I think once a week or once or every couple of weeks. And he basically teaches photography to fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And, you know, they do the whole – at the end of the school year, they have the big gallery. They sell off some of the pictures that they've taken to help raise money for the school and other things. It's just a really cool thing.
Very
cool. But he's just one of those – high energy guys that can pretty much walk up to you as a complete stranger and, you know, within a couple of minutes walk away your best friend. And if you ever see the friendly banter that goes on between him and some of the guys like, you know, Scott Kelby and Joe McNally and those guys, you know, we always joke about, you know, giving V your cell phone number. And because it's one of those, you know, when he gets an idea, he gets really, you know, motivated about it. And next thing you know, you're getting text messages at any time of the night, you know, saying, hey, I came up with this great idea, you know.
Cool.
And I love seeing that. And I love being around that because, you know, that kind of attitude spreads.
Yeah, you just feed off of that probably, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I love to do whenever I'm assisting him on some of his photo shoots is just shut up and listen, because the stuff that you pick up, you know, it's crazy because he'll go around, he'll start, you know, adjusting lighting, looking, you know, talking to the model about poses and this and that. And he'll start talking about camera settings and just trying to soak all that stuff up. A lot of times I'll have a pen and paper there just to write it down because I'm not going to remember a lot of the stuff that's going on.
Oh, that's good. I thought I was the only one that doesn't remember squat. So good to know. Good to know I'm not alone.
Oh, no. Yeah, exactly. But you know how you go out and, you know, it doesn't have to be photography. It can be anything. You know, you go out and you're just so mentally engrossed in this project and you're just, you know, basically all in on it. When you're done, you know, say the photo shoot was 2 hours and you were inside of an air conditioned studio. It's not like you were doing a major karate workout or anything,
right.
But you still go home and you just feel drained because, you know, just mentally and emotionally, you were just so amped up and there's so much energy flowing around just that he was creating that it's just an amazing thing to experience.
Yeah. And you know what, Scott Kelby's the same way. I don't know if – well, you said you've been to Photoshop World and taken his classes, so you know firsthand what Scott Kelby's like. And, you know, like you said, there's people like that where they're constantly at this high energy level. And, well, like, you know, that's what I did is I just shut up. You know, it was a please teach me kind of thing. So, and what kind of stuff did you do as his photo assistant? Were you, like handing him lights and setting camera settings and light settings or carrying gear? Like, what kind of stuff did you actually physically do for him?
Oh, pretty much, you know, full gamut, everything. You know, I'd help him set up, you know, all the gear, all the lighting. You know, I'll run around and check, you know, the light setting, you know, all the lighting, the power settings on them, where they're aimed at. If he wants to say we're shooting with four studio lights and they're set up in a certain configuration and now we want to move them to a different configuration, he'll pretty much just say what he wants done and I'll run around and move them to where they need to be or – you know, a lot of times one of the things I do is I look at the really small details like the model's hair. Cause you know, you get some of those strands that go kind of crazy and you can get rid of them in Photoshop, but sometimes they can be kind of tedious to get rid of. And, you know, everything from, you know, a button is like half undone or, you know, just something turned just the wrong way on her wardrobe or outfit or something. So it's one of those, you know, when, you know, I've noticed this at my own shoots, when you have your head in the camera, you can't really see those small details. You're kind of focusing on
the big
the whole, right, exactly, the whole setting all at once. And so, you know, I'll stand either next to him or just off to the side and I'll look at the small details because I don't have my head down in a camera. And a lot of times, you know, I'll say, oh, hang on, and run in and fix something and, you know, that he hadn't noticed. And like I said, it's the same thing with me when I'm on a shoot, you know, and I have someone there assisting me, same thing. I'll tell them, you know, look at the details because I'm not going to see them.
Right. And you think that that's probably, it sounds like that's pretty characteristic of what assistants do is take care of the smaller stuff, the finer points while they're looking at the bigger picture, help with setup, help with tear down, that kind of thing. So, wow, that's really, and that must be high energy doing that stuff for 4 or 6 hours, I can see how that would be pretty draining for you. Wow, that's just intense. And he's got a website too that we should probably also throw up in the show notes too, doesn't he? We should probably throw a link to there, because, and I know when he mentioned your name on Scott Kelby's blog, that must have been a pretty interesting spike in chatter for you the next day as well.
Oh yeah, I've had so, some of those guys from, I've had some of those NAB guys, like, you know, Scott Kelby, he's linked to a couple of posts that I made. RC over on Layers magazine, he linked to a few, and just recently Matt Kleskowski mentioned the blog on Photoshop User TV episode, I think 190.
Oh wow.
And so it's funny, you see your normal graph that's just kind of, you know, a flat graph, and then all of a sudden you log into it and then it's like this straight vertical spike that goes through the roof, and you're like, oh man, what the heck just happened?
Yeah, that same thing happened to me when Dave Cross actually mentioned me on his blog just completely in passing. And I hadn't even realized it, and I saw this spike one day, and I was going to all the sites I thought might have done it. So I looked at Scott Kelby's site, I looked at Photoshop User, I looked at Layers TV, you know, all these big name blogs, and for some reason it just didn't dawn on me to look at Dave Cross's blog that day. Cause I'd visit his like every 3 days, you know, catch up on the feeds and things like that. So like 3 days later I realized, oh my God, that came from him and I never thanked him. So I quickly ran over and made a post there. But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. When you see those spikes, it's always like, whoa, what happened? Well, that's really cool. So what we'll do is we'll throw a link to Robert Vanelli's site and the link over on Scott Kelby's blog where he mentioned your site as well. But that kind of is a good segue point, because websites, I think, is probably one of the most dominant ways that we advertise or market or network or try and get the word out about the stuff that we're doing and trying to share that with others. But there's a lot of other ways that I know a lot of people like to network with others in photography or related to photography. And I know a couple of them, like we've chatted up a couple times on Twitter. And I know you said before that you're a member of the NAP forums. I don't think I've seen you post a lot in there, though. So I'd like you to do it now just as kind of like an outro for the conversation. If you could just maybe share a couple of the social networking outlets that you utilize, what you utilize them for, and where people basically can get a hold of you and find out more about you and your work.
Okay. I think the site that I use the most is Twitter. And my name on there is TKR Photo.
Okay.
And that one it's very convenient because you can just kind of just throw something up there really fast. So whenever I make a new blog post, I'll stick something on there.
Sure.
But predominantly what I use it for is to actually converse, because a lot of times when these, you know, when people follow me and I'll go check out, you know, their page, you know, the people who are just like new blog post, new blog post, new blog post, and that's all they have, I'm not really gonna follow them, because I can subscribe to their RSS feed and get what I want out of
right.
that. You know, I like to use Twitter for personal interaction. I like to see, you know, actual people on there, not just, you know, bots posting stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Well, I don't think any of us are bot fans. So, and
right.
you said you use it for like conversing. So, is it more? Would you say that's more for networking then?
Yeah, I definitely use it more networking and. Things of that nature. I mean, I post a wide range of stuff up there. I mean, sometimes I'll talk about photography. Other times I'll talk about going to the gym or doing workouts or whatnot. So there is a little bit of my personal life in there, but not as much as, you know, other people do personal life
right.
stuff on there. But I don't stay just to photography on there either. So it's kind of a wide range.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes Twitter fun, is that you can have the work-related stuff or the hobby stuff on there, you know, for depending on your level of interest in photography and things like that. But you can also throw other personal things in there and create a good mix. And I think that's what people that follow me anyway and people that I follow tend to have in their content. Like if I see someone jumps in and follows me, and then every day it's like you said, new blog post, new blog post, new blog post. Well, unfollow, subscribe RSS feed, done. You know, that,
exactly.
You know, that kind of thing. And what kind of people do you usually find interesting on Twitter that you tend to gear towards? Do you look more for people who have photography backgrounds? Do you look more for people who have engineering backgrounds? What kind of interests do other people have on Twitter that you look for?
I think predominantly my list is mostly photographers or artists. But really, if they're interesting, I'll follow an underwater basket weaver.
Hey, that was my major in college.
Yeah. Hey, mine too. How funny.
Go figure. What are the odds of that?
I did programming on the side,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, of course.
it's one of those, if they're interesting and they have something interesting to say,
right,
then I'll follow. And by interesting, I mean something that interests me, because I'm sure there's a lot of interesting people out there that just bore the living hell out of
yeah.
me because my interests aren't in line with theirs.
Unless
so.
It's underwater basket weaving, then you kind of have to follow, so, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, heck, that's I got to follow that industrial trend, you know.
Hey, that's the latest craze, man. Underwater basket.
That's right.
You had mentioned something about what was it? Facebook or MySpace? You also use one of those?
I have both, but I really don't. MySpace is purely personal and I log into it maybe once every 3 to 4 months.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, Facebook, I actually have my own personal Facebook, and then I have the fan page on top of it, and I have a whole 50, let's see, what is it right now? 56 fans. That's just awesome.
It's 55 more than I have on my Facebook page, so you're
I think I have a fan page. I think 50 of them are like related to me or friends, so they're kind of required to be my friend. You know?
At least you got them, man. At least you got them. So what's your Facebook link? I don't think I've even looked at your Facebook page yet.
Well, because I have under 1,000 fans, I don't have a direct – you know, because they just let you start actually having those direct names. And so I don't have one for mine. But if you just go on to their search and type in Terry Reinert, then assuming you spelled it correctly, you'll see my fan page and my personal one.
Oh, okay, cool. So go onto Facebook and search for Terry Reinert. Go ahead and spell your last name then for the listening audience so they know how to find you.
All right, Reinert.
Cool. And Terry, correct?
Yes.
Please don't be Terry with an I, because you're a guy. That would be kind of weird.
Yeah. So, and there's one listener out there going, hey, wait a minute, I'm Terry with an I. What's
I know,
wrong
I'm going to offend someone out there and watch.
You just demolished his whole self-esteem. You ruined his whole picture-perfect life.
Go figure. That, you know, there's always someone that's going to be disappointed. So my apologies if I've insulted someone there. So we've got you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, and your website is tkrphoto.com.
Yes, sir.
Is that what it is, sir?
Yes.
Hey, you're the guy that went further in the military than I did. I should be calling you, sir. Another little caveat there is we're both former military. Terry is a former Marine, and I am a former Army sergeant. So we both achieved sergeant status, but I think his sergeant went a little higher. You were what, an E7?
Five.
Oh, that's
E5.
That's an E5 too? Oh, we were both E5. Okay. I thought in the Marines it went higher. Guess not.
Well, you know, because we weren't officers, neither of us should be calling each other
that's
sir.
Right.
Because, you
that's
know,
right. Yeah.
Don't call me sir, I work for
exactly.
a living.
Exactly. So. It's the three up,
and
three
that's going to generate some hate mail right there.
Yeah, no doubt.
No, I mean, we love you. We love everybody. We're just joking.
I know. Well, and truth be told, actually, my brother is an officer in the Army, although I will refuse till the end of my days to call him sir. He is not a sir. He is Matt.
That's right.
Sorry, Matt, not calling you, sir. Well, great, Terry. Listen, I really want to appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk to us. We've got about 40 seconds left before we got a break for another commercial, so unless there's anything else you'd like to say, I'll thank you again for taking the time to sit down and talk, and we'll catch you on the flip side.
All right, well, I really appreciate being on. Thanks for inviting me to come on. It was a lot of fun.
Great. Thanks, Terry. We'll talk to you later.
All right, take care.
Bye. Welcome back. As you can tell, that really was a fun session talking to Terry. We had quite the blast, and we commented after we went off the air that we probably could have gone on talking shop for another couple hours without even realizing it. So I'm going to keep the rest of the show fairly short here. There are some contest news announcements I wanted to share with you, though. Number one, the latest contest, which is going on right now, you can win a copy of the On1 Software plugin suite. This is version 4.5. It's in full swing right now. Throw up some images. Actually, you can throw up one image. Everyone is limited to one image this go around. There is a Flickr thread that has been up. The theme for this month's contest is numbers, since it's On1 Software. So tie it into numbers if you can, and throw your best image up in the photo thread to win this software. This software is valued retail at $500. So this is a pretty huge, generous offer coming from the good folks over at On1. I'd like to take a moment to thank them for sponsoring this contest, and I would like to wish everyone luck and make sure that you
get your images submitted before the end of the month, because that, believe it or not, is rapidly approaching. The second contest news item for this podcast is also with regard to last month's contest. There was one going on where you could win a discount coupon to the PhotoQuote Pro software from the folks over at Cradock. They have this PhotoQuote Pro software where you can analyze your market, and they'll give you quotes of how much you should be charging for your photography for different usages, whether it's for a magazine, whether it's for a newspaper, whether it's for a publication, whether it's for a book, what the distribution is, all the different kinds of factors to take into consideration. And this software does that for you. It's really great software. All you had to do to participate was post a comment to the blog during the month of June. Congratulations go out to Fred from his participation on the blog. He submitted a comment. I put all the comments in a spreadsheet. Then I picked a random number out of, I think, the 65 comments or something like that. I had a total of 65 or 70 comments and put a random number in. Once I got everyone's name listed down, and his name popped up, so he won the discount. Thank you to everyone for contributing their comments, thoughts, and participating on the blog. We'll have another contest to that end coming up in a little bit, but the last piece of contest news for this week is actually our contest for next month. Next month, starting in August, the good folks at Wacom have contributed a Bamboo Fun Small to give away here on the blog. We don't have the Flickr thread up yet, and the theme is also still to be determined, but if you're interested in getting a tablet, hold off on getting one. You could have a chance at winning a Bamboo Fun, the small version, I think it's a 4x6 or 3x5 touchpad. I forget what the dimensions are, but it's the small size Bamboo Fun, sufficient for most people's uses probably. We're going to be giving one of those away. I think the retail value on that is $100, so it's a very generous offer from them as well. And that's coming up in the month of August, so you're going to want to stay tuned to find out what the theme is for that and the Flickr thread for that giveaway as well. I'd like to thank everyone that has been contributing to the contests here on Learning Digital Photography. We've had quite a few lately. We've had the Adobe contest a couple months ago. We had the PhotoQuote Pro, we've got OnOne Software. Coming up, we've got the Wacom giveaway. I'm trying to see what other discounts and giveaways people would like to sponsor, but if you have something you'd be interested in, by all means, let me know. You can let me know at jason@canonblogger.com to let me know what kinds of products you would like to see make their way into the contest themes. I will always listen to what listeners have to say on that subject, so feel free to submit your ideas for that as well. Coming back after the break, we're going to round things out with some listener questions and answers, so don't go away. Welcome back. And rounding out the show this week, our listener questions and answers come to us from, there's actually three really good questions this week. Our first one comes to us from Jeremy in Wyoming, and he writes in to ask about a term he's heard recently called the exposure triangle. He mentions that he understands shutters and apertures, how those relate, but he's never heard of the exposure triangle before and wanted to know if I could explain that in a little more detail. Jeremy, this is a great question, and it does key in on the fact that there is a relationship not only between shutter and aperture, but also your speed, and that in olden days used to be the ASA speed of your film. In today's terms, in today's terminology, the semantics we use are ISO settings, so the noise levels that you're willing to accept inside your digital images. So the three settings that are in the exposure triangle are shutter, aperture, and ISO settings for digital photography, and if you change one and keep the second constant, then you're going to have to change the third one in the opposite direction. So if you keep a constant ISO setting and you increase your shutter speed, you're going to have to decrease your aperture or widen the opening to keep the same exposure level. And that exposure triangle refers to the relationship between all three of those, where if you change any two, you're also going to have to change a third, or at least keep the third controlled for, so you can manage your exposures correctly. It's a great question, Jeremy. I know a lot of people have probably not heard of that term before themselves, so I thank you very much for bringing that to the attention. It's actually kind of an interesting theory, and I may do a blog post on that as well. So it's a great question. Thank you for submitting that to the podcast. Our second question comes to us from Christy in Arizona. Christy writes in to ask what all the different types of filters are. She's having a hard time keeping all the usages straight, and that's understandable with all the different types that are out there. And she asked if I could cover briefly what the different types do. Christy, thank you very much for the question. I'd be happy to cover that. This almost could be a full segment for the podcast, but I'm going to explain two basic types of filters and then go into a little bit more detail on each and then leave it off at that because I may resume this in our next podcast and go into some more details. But the two basic types of filters that I look at are ND filters, neutral density filters, and polarizing filters. Now, what a neutral density filter does, or an ND filter, we just call them ND filters, what a neutral density filter does is it's basically a gray filter. It reduces the amount of light that you bring into your camera. So if you're trying to get that blurred or that smooth water where you've got the nice blur and you've got the flowing down, what it's basically doing is it's reducing the amount of light in all color wavelengths. Now, there are variations on this. There's split neutral density filters where the top half is a lighter shade and the bottom half is a darker shade. Those are used for sunrises and sunsets where you want a lighter exposure on the foreground and a darker exposure on the horizon level so that you can get a blended exposure. They also have graduated neutral density filters that do that in incremental portions across the entire range of the filter, but for the most part, a neutral density filter reduces the amount of light that enters the camera. And depending on what you're looking for, you can get specific functions for specific types of photography. You want to make sure when you're purchasing an ND filter for your camera, though, that your ND filter size matches the lens that you're going to be putting it on, because different lenses will have different filter sizes. So you want to make sure you match the filter size to the lens size, and that holds true for any kind of filter. So that's the neutral density. The same holds true, though, also for polarizing filters, and that's the other kind I want to talk about. Now, there's basically two types of polarizing filters. There's linear polarizers and circular polarizers. And if you think about light and the way it enters your lens, it's going to enter your lens from a whole bunch of different types of angles, but the two predominant angles that you can look at light from are vertically and horizontally. It comes on two planes. And what a linear polarizing filter does is it cuts out horizontal waves. All right. And if you look at a circular polarizing filter, it'll cut it out from horizontal and vertical waves. So you can get a lot more reduction of lens flare, of reflections, of things of that nature. It's going to make things more polarized. It's going to reduce more of the polarization that happens. And one of the cool things is if you take two polarizing filters and put them on top of each other, it will actually cancel out pretty much all the light coming in. And that's a neat little way that you can test sunglasses. So if a sunglasses manufacturer says, well, we have polarized lenses, one way you can test that is to take one of your polarizing filters out and put it in front of that. And if you can't see any light, then that is a truly polarized lens that's in the sunglasses. So that's a kind of a neat little trick there. But there are linear polarizing lenses and there are circular polarizing lenses. Linear only cancel out one of the waves of polarizing light, circular cancels out both. And that's the purpose that you use in polarizing lenses. You're reducing wavelengths of light, and this will prevent reflections, this will make for bluer skies, things of that nature. And it's very useful, especially if you're doing water photography, because the water can reflect you if you're trying to capture, say, a sunset or a sunrise or some kind of landscape scenery. The water can reflect you, and if you're not careful to use a polarizing filter, you can get yourself in the frame by accident. If you're shooting a window, a polarizing filter can reduce the impact of that reflection as well. It makes skies a lot bluer too, but anyway, I don't want to go into more details about it because that could be a good podcast segment, and I just wanted to briefly cover what the different types do. Those are the two main ones that I've had experience with. I'm sure there are others out there, gelling type filters where you can change the color of the light, but the two main ones that I've used in my experience are ND filters and polarizing filters, so I covered both of those. Thank you, Christy, though. That was a great question. I really do appreciate you contributing to the podcast. Our last question comes to us from Dennis in Texas, and Dennis writes in to ask what a hair light is and where to position it. And I think he probably has an idea of what a hair light is, because a hair light
is a light that accentuates the hair. And if, for example, if you've got a black background and your model has black hair, it can be difficult to see where the hair ends and where the background begins. And one of the ways you can give some definition to that hair or accentuate a model's hair is to put a hair light by the model. And the best place to position a hair light for most conventional types of photography is to put it behind the model and below, so the light is shooting up towards the back of their head. And that way that can give some definition and some edges to the hair that you might otherwise lose if the hair color is the same as the background. So those are the three questions this week. Thank you to Jeremy, Christy, and Dennis. I appreciate you all writing in. Appreciate everyone writing in. And if you do have a question you would like addressed on the podcast, you can get a hold of me. I'm available on Twitter. You can go to twitter.com/CBJason. You can get a hold of me on Facebook. My username on Facebook, I believe, is Jason Anderson. And you can also write to me here at the blog. My email address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. Or if you want, you can just go ahead and throw a question in the comments section, and I'll see what I can do to get your question in on the show. Thank you very much to everyone that's been participating. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time here at Learning Digital Photography. Have a good week, everyone. Bye.